Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. We now have one of the main sessions of our conference today, where we have five very eminent personalities to give us their very different perspectives on NATO as seen by others. But to take us through this session, I'm extremely pleased and honored to welcome back an old friend, Constanza Stelzenmüller. Constanza, this is your session to moderate. The floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie. Good morning, everybody. Secretary Generals, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, and Jamie, thank you very much for inviting me to moderate this panel on NATO as seen by others today. And yes, my name is Constanze Stelzenmüller. I'm a senior transatlantic fellow at the German Marshall Fund in Berlin. And of course, it is a great pleasure and in fact quite a relief to be moderating this panel after Nick Gowing, who as an ultra-professional has cracked his whip this morning and shown everybody exactly how it's going to be done. So I don't even need to use this anymore because I hope you're all already conditioned. Now, NATO as seen by others. This panel, in other words, will look at NATO's relations with the rest of the world from the outside, at least mostly. What has changed since the last strategic concept in 1999, when indeed I first met Jamie because I was a young journalist writing about both the strategic concept and the NATO air war over Kosovo at the same time? Before 1999, of course, we had the Euro-Atlantic Partnership Council, we had Partnership for Peace, we had the NATO-Russia Founding Act. But so much has happened in the decade since. 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, NATO and EU enlargement, the creation of ESDP, which didn't exist in 1999, EU operations, gas crises, the Georgian-Russian war, and finally, a global financial crisis. And the result has been a proliferation of new partnerships, formal and informal, for NATO, which does indeed reach around the globe. In this context, 60 years after World War II, 20 years after the fall of the wall, important date for me as a German, the framework of the post-war international order as created by the transatlantic alliance, including the United Nations, NATO, of course, the EU and others, has, as we know, proven remarkably resilient. But at the same time, we know that the alliance and NATO's effectiveness is increasingly under strain and its legitimacy questioned, in some cases even challenged, by the rise of new powers, some of whom are openly critical of NATO, some of whom are critical and interested. Let me name Russia, China, India, I could name many others. And in this context, what does the rest of the world mean for NATO? Who are these others in the title of our panel? Are they potential partners? Are they potential rivals? Are they potential sources of threats as failing or failed states? Possibly. Or are they threats in themselves through their governments? And how must NATO adapt to this changed scenery that I've just described? With us today to discuss these issues are five very distinguished speakers. And I will introduce each one of them. Dr. Mohammed El-Baradei, our first speaker, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, since 1997, after a distinguished career as an Egyptian diplomat, international civil servant and scholar, and of course the recipient of a joint Nobel Peace Prize in 2005 together with his organization. He will represent here the world of international organizations who have to cooperate with NATO on occasion, and if you will, the wilder world. He will, I'm sure, also have something to say about nuclear risks and security. Secondly, I will call on Professor Antonio Vitorino, an EU Commissioner for Justice and Home Affairs for 10 years between 1994 and 2004, from Portugal, a lawyer, parliamentarian, scholar, and past holder of several cabinet positions, including Minister for Defence. He will provide us with a European and EU perspective. Then Dr. Dmitry Trenin will come third, director of the Carnegie Moscow Center and a member since its inception, one of Russia's foremost strategic experts following a career in the Soviet and Russian armed forces from the early 1970s, including I was interested to learn as a liaison officer in the external relations branch of the group of Soviet forces then stationed in Potsdam. So he knows Germany well from an earlier era. He will give us a view from Russia. Fourth, Lord Levine of Portsoken, chairman of Lloyd's of London since 2002. Lloyd's, of course, is the world's leading specialist insurance and reinsurance market. And Lord Levine has had a long and illustrious career in business and government and banking, including as Lord Mayor of London. He will give us a business view on the risks and threats. And finally, Dr. Paolo Scaroni, Chief Executive Officer of Eni, the Italian energy company, one of the world's leading energy companies since 2005, will give us a corporate sector view. Now, we will proceed much in the same way as Nick Gowing did in the first panel. I would like to get the views of each of our speakers in turn, briefly please, no more than 7 to 9 minutes. I will give you each a question and you may pretend to answer it. And while this session will begin as a debate among the panel, I will also want to encourage the audience to participate as soon as possible. So as in the first panel, please send me your questions, if you'd like, through the ladies who also have the microphones, and I will try and put them in some semblance of order. It would be useful, though, if you, as you write down your questions, if you could tell me whom you'd like to address them to, and then I could ask somebody on the panel to respond. And they can, in fact, be comments or questions, but should be short and to the point. And when I call on you to ask them, it would be nice if you could state your name and affiliation again. And I would like to suggest that you take as your example that brilliant introduction by Sven Mikser, who said, "I haven't got much to say, but I will say it briefly." So with that, let me lead over to Dr. Mohamed El-Baradei. Dr. El-Baradei, NATO has been engaged in Afghanistan since 2002. That's now longer than the West in World War II. Does the course of the Afghan mission argue for a NATO role as a global security provider? Floor is yours.
Costanza, I think you touch on a very important question, you know, whether we are trying to establish a security system that is global, in and out of area, as the Secretary General mentioned, or are we going to, as in the past, define or limit our role to what is exactly impact on our own interest. I would argue that right now we have a global security system that is dysfunctional. The new threats are quite different from the ones in the past. I don't have to repeat them. We don't have the institutions that are adapted to deal with these threats. And we continue to rely on means that are no longer adequate to address these risks. So when basically, what we see today is a United Nations that is not always functioning as it should. You know, in many cases, regional organizations do not have the capacity. You are the only one who really have the infrastructure and capacity. You have, and you see quite often a dichotomy between legality and legitimacy. You intervened in Kosovo, was not legal, but was legitimate. You have non-proliferation regime right now, which is legal, but becoming more illegitimate or lack legitimacy. So these are issues that we need to address. NATO has been perceived in the past, at least, as the club of the rich and famous, dealing with a specific threat, the Soviet threat. That threat has disappeared. And now people look at NATO and ask a number of questions. Is NATO really part of a global security, a senior partner of a global security system, or NATO is Eurocentric, focusing on transatlantic mission to the exclusion of other important security threats that we are facing? I mean, you mentioned Afghanistan. How about Darfur? People ask that question. When we have 200,000 people died, millions are displaced, and we cannot get 18 helicopters. Not a single helicopter right now exists in Darfur. We can't get the 18,000 troops. People ask the question that a security system based on human security and human solidarity, or based on narrow national interest? And that's a question you need to address. What is your mission, frankly? Are you want to link with the rest of the world and be a senior partner, a subcontractor for a central system manned by the Security Council, or are you going to continue to work through some partnership? That is a fundamental question you have to. Partnership to me is not, for example, if Russia is one issue major to you, I read your declaration, it says you're looking for Europe united and whole. And then I ask, what is the criteria for joining NATO? Can Russia at one day be a member of NATO, according to your concept? Secretary, talk about relationship with the EU. If you are not able to work with the EU, properly, how are you going to be part of the global security system? When I see Turkey here is part of NATO, having resistance being part of the EU, how that doesn't really send me a good message. You have to first define that security has become global, the risk has changed, and you have to lead the way. That's how I see it. You will have to engage into peacekeeping, humanitarian assistance, and I can understand that you're not going to do everything, obviously, but you have a responsibility to train, empower regional organizations like the EU, the Arab League, and to do their bit, to do their task in dealing with some of the most major issues we are facing, which is ethnic, conflict, terrorism, weapons of mass destruction. You have to continue to decrease heavily your reliance on nuclear weapons. If I look at your declaration, the supreme guarantee is nuclear weapons. It would stop any war whatsoever. You are really sending absolutely a message that if you want to protection, if you want power, develop nuclear weapons. That's the message. If anybody would read your concept, basically the message is we need to develop nuclear weapons. And how would that would correlate with Barack Obama's and Alexander Medvedev and everybody else's, message that we need to get out of nuclear weapons. So there is a lot of adaptation that need to take place here in NATO. You need to be part of a global system. You need to reach out. You need to, why do you call yourself an alliance, for example? If that's really the right word. Would partnership be a better word? These are, fundamental issues. And it's not a question about just a concept paper. It's a question about what do you want to contribute and how could you contribute to a global security system, which we know is indivisible. That is, and in doing all this, you have to engage fully public opinion. We know that without public opinion engagement in defense issues, like in trade, like in environment, we'll go nowhere. They need to understand that this has to do with their survival, and they have to be with us in every step of the way.
Thank you very much. That was both a magisterial tour d'horizon and admirably short of my actual time limit that I gave you, so thank you. It also seems to me that you've both answered and not answered my question by saying that, yes, NATO does indeed, because of the changing global landscape and the changing nature of the risks it faces, does need to become a global security provider and right. Seek new partners. But you, I think, have politely declined or remained silent on the issue of whether Afghanistan, the Afghanistan operation and its course, proves that point.
Well, I think Afghanistan is again, of a symptom of, A, not addressing the root causes, and that is something we need to forget. Again, I have to mention that unless you address the root causes, which is development issues, essentially, terrorism, is really, when you talk about terrorism, when you talk about WMDs, you have to talk about the 2 billion people who live under $2. I always say poverty is the most lethal weapon of mass destruction. So you need security, you need to address the root causes. The festering conflict in Kashmir and in Middle East, Palestine, in South Asia. You cannot just look at the symptoms. You have to reach far and wide and address the root causes. Afghanistan is also because you haven't really empowered other regional organizations and make them able to share the burden with you. And you have a Security Council right now that is only focused on the stick, which in most cases, if not all cases, completely counterproductive. Sanction lead to more confrontation. You need to work, a Security Council work on prevention, work on finding a solution to disputes, working on peacekeeping.
Okay, thank you very much. That brings me very neatly to my next speaker, Dr. Vitorino, who is here as, who stands in, if you will, for the European Union. Now, we know that the European Union has done a lot in the last decade to up its military power through ESDP, the European Security Strategy, operations, and of course a lot of the NATO troops in Afghanistan are actually European, but the fact remains that Europe needs the US as a force and influence multiplier or provider. And the Secretary General in his introductory speech noted his deep disappointment at the lack of the coordination between the NATO and EU as one of the world's greatest soft power providers. And the, if you will, the real, the one institution that should be able to help NATO in its comprehensive approach. Now my question to you, Professor Vitorino, is, as we know, and again I'm sticking with Afghanistan as a case example because I think it focuses our minds a bit. In Afghanistan, ISAF is becoming Americanized by an American troop surge, much needed of course. But what should Europe now do to pull its weight? Preserve its influence, of course. Send troops, increase diplomacy, improve its development efforts. Send euros, send checks, the way we Germans used to do.
Well, thank you so much. I will come back to Afghanistan at the end of my very short presentation. I believe that when we try to focus on the relationship between NATO and the European Union, as a positive point, we have to recognize that the European Union came about with a security strategy in 2003 and updated it in 2008. And it is extremely important to build on that strategy to reinforce the relationship with NATO. It is also true that in between, the United States have clarified their commitment and engagement with the transatlantic link and with European defense, which has not always been the case, and that it has raised some doubts in Europe about the American commitment. And last but not least, the French have reintegrated the military NATO structure. All those elements, I recommend that we should have a major review on the prospects of the relationship between the European Union and and NATO. On the positive side, I also sign that both organizations share a broad range definition of threats. The danger here is that probably both are tempted to overemphasize the security implications of those threats, and dealing with those threats will require much more just than the use of military or enforcement, law enforcement powers. What do I mean by this? I mean by this that, first of all, some of the threats can only be dealt with if we improve our capability to prevent them. And I must say that in prevention, NATO has not a very high profile. Having said that, there is a second consequence from the conceptual point of view. These threats put into question the traditional division between internal security and external security at national level. The answer to these threats will require the articulation of several institutions, like the military, undoubtedly, but also the police, the intelligence, the civil protection, and we should try to respect as much as possible what each institution is prepared and capable to do. We should not ask the police to perform tasks that the police is not prepared to. We should not ask the military to perform tasks that the military are not equipped nor prepared to. My third remark is just to say that, in my assumption, collective defense is still at the core of NATO vocation. Striking the right balance between collective defense and the new missions also means that NATO will meet the European Union each time more and more in several theaters of operation in these new missions. And that will probably oblige us to revisit the arrangements between NATO and the EU when it comes to that cooperation. It will require, and obviously, mutual trust between the European Union and NATO. And here the buzzword is avoid duplication. But when one institution says that it wants to avoid duplication, it means that the others should not get the means that they have already. And I think that in here, humility should be shared by all. NATO should recognize that the EU has a wide set of instruments to deal with crisis management and post-conflict reconstruction. And that component of the EU is an added value that NATO should incorporate and cooperate with. On the other side, and I now come to Afghanistan to conclude, the Europeans should recognize the shared shortcomings of their own military capabilities. The rising up of military capabilities in the European Union framework will be incremental. And definitely the current financial crisis and the general trend of cutting expenses will not be helpful to the targets that the European Union will have to achieve in the near future when it comes to building up military capabilities. Therefore, I think that in Afghanistan, the reality is that we have a perfect case study for European standards. We could not dream of a better case study. Self-defense, Security Council resolution, endorsement by NATO. So everything should look perfect in Afghanistan. The problem with Afghanistan, with Europeans, is that our public opinion gives us contradictory signs in this respect. They are strongly in favor of foreign policy, defense policy. They consider that terrorism is a priority in the fight for security, but when it comes to the necessity of engaging men and women in arms in Afghanistan, our public opinion looks very much reluctant. This is not a problem of public relations, I'm afraid. This is a problem of building a narrative that establishes the continuity between soft power and hard power. We need to make the case that if we want to be effective in using traditional European instruments of soft power, there is a moment where it is unavoidable that hard power comes into place to make it credible. And this is a challenge both for the EU and NATO. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Vitorino. If I might follow up on that very briefly and ask you for brief responses. If, as you say, and I utterly agree with you, that Afghanistan, because it is a case of legitimate self-defense, ought to be the case where we all get it right. Why are we not getting it right? Why is the EU and the European member states in particular having such an incredibly hard time implementing the comprehensive approach which we know to be right? Is it because decision-making has and coordination has become impossible in an EU at 27? Or is it because our political leaders have failed, and I do say failed here on purpose, to convince our publics of the necessity for this operation and for its success?
I think that there are two lines to answer your question. First of all, there is a problem of leadership, yes. You need to make it clear that security costs money, and this is not popular. I mean, you are not re-elected if you start approaching an election saying security costs money. This is true, difficult to sell to the common citizen. It is also difficult to sell to the business, and I must say that to a certain extent, security also will cost more money to the business sector. But anyway, I will leave that to the business representatives here. But there is a second problem indeed. We need to build a narrative where we demonstrate that our European values should be in line not only with the use of soft power, of which we are experts and we are very successful, but that the use of soft power requires, in given circumstances, a complementary use of hard power. And we are lagging behind our capability to assume our responsibilities when it comes to hard power, and that is a problem of popular consent. It is not a problem of public relations. It's a problem of democratic popular consent. Okay.
Thanks very much, Professor Vitorino. With that, I would like to move to Dr. Dmitry Trenin, who is here to explain to us whether Russia can and wants to be a partner for NATO. Now, we've just seen the American-Russian meetings over strategic nuclear arms control. Clearly, there's an effort at constructive engagement there. We've had the NATO-Russia Council meeting in Corfu after a long hiatus. But, of course, the relationship, to put it bluntly, has been rather rocky of late. Russia has cast itself repeatedly as the loser of the Cold War, complained about NATO going ever farther afield, and, of course, NATO enlargement proper. There has been a strong sense of ambivalent resentment, a lack of constructive proposals, and we're still all not quite sure whether the idea of a European security architecture is a constructive proposal or the opposite. So my question to you is, can you explain to us whether the Russian leadership sees NATO as a potential partner or a rival? Or does it see it as belonging in the dustbin of history? And if it does see it as a partner, where are the red lines for Russia?
Constanze, thank you so much. And thank you in particular for reminding me of my youth. A lot of water has flown under the bridge, the Glinica Bridge in Potsdam. A lot has changed in this world for the better. NATO started as a defense alliance. It emerged as, I would say, the premier pillar of European security. But 20 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there's one bit of post-Cold War business which is still unfinished. And that is fitting the former Soviet lands into the Euro-Atlantic security compact. And essentially, the heart of the matter is Russia's non-inclusion, but it affects other nations. And this affects, in particular, Russia's neighbors. You mentioned the war last August, the war in the Caucasus. I would add the tensions that war produced in Crimea. And if anything, this points to the reality and potential severity of the problem. Now, I don't think there's an easy or simple way to solve that problem. Russia's membership in NATO, which people discussed at the beginning of the 90s and then again at the beginning of this decade, is not on the cards. But east of Berlin, despite all the discussion this morning, east of Berlin, NATO is still perceived primarily as being about Russia. And that is where Moscow and Minsk, Tallinn and Tbilisi are on the same wavelength. But from an analyst's point of view, and I stress this analytical quality of the statement that will follow, safe limits of NATO's enlargement to the east have been reached. I'm not saying that all limits have been reached, but safe limits have certainly been reached. If we talk about Ukraine, then I think the issue is not so much Russia's opposition to Ukraine's potential NATO membership. If Ukraine were of one mind, overwhelmingly of one mind, on NATO membership, then no force in the world, and in particular Russia, would have been able to stand in the way. The problem is that the nation, as we all know, is very much split on that issue. Most Ukrainians, actually all Ukrainians, don't want to be part of Russia, but most of them don't want to part with Russia. And that's an issue to be factored in. To force a choice on a nation so split would be courting disaster. With regard to Georgia, we have a different problem. Of course, most Georgians agree that the threat comes from the north. And they do see Russia as an adversary. And they have seen Russia as an adversary for some time. But the issue of borders poses a danger of a conflict or importing a conflict with Russia, which is something, again, worth very serious consideration. And clearly, Abkhazia, as we all know, was not lost last August, but rather a decade and a half before. Probably Ossetia was lost finally as a result of the attack that happened in August. Yesterday, an agreement was reached on START, some kind of a framework agreement. Essentially, it's a symbolic document. It basically regulates a terribly and terrifyingly obsolete relationship, strategic relationship between Russia and the United States of America. But I'm gratified to see some language in what the two presidents agreed upon on missile defense that gives you some encouragement. I'm trying, as you would realize, I'm trying to look for ways of fitting both Russia and its neighbors into a common security framework with the rest of Europe and North America. The focus for now is on the third site of missile defense in Central Europe. But the issue is not how to get the third site out of the way. Rather, the issue, in my view, is to move forward toward a fundamentally new relationship between Russia and the United States in the strategic area. We need to get out of the icebox of Cold War-style mutual assured destruction and start joint work, as Dr. El-Bardai said, start joint work on strategic collaboration. I would be looking for signs that would suggest that at some future meeting between an American and a Russian president, the two will direct their subordinates to do a feasibility study of joint missile defenses that would include Americans, Russians, and Europeans. That is, to me, a potential beginning of a security community. And, as NATO knows, a security community is not exactly the same thing as a values community. My next point, that community could extend well beyond Europe. Even missile defenses in Europe would look out to the greater Middle East area. In Afghanistan, support for NATO operation by the Russians could also lead to more regional collaboration, including also the Shanghai Security Cooperation. On Iran, of course, Russia is not to Iran what China is to North Korea, but Iran is no North Korea. It's a country to be addressed with a lot more circumspection and a lot more seriousness. And this issue is emerging, I think, the Iran nuclear issue, is emerging as eminently the most important issue for the entire world and potentially the most serious threat to world peace in the months and years to come. To wrap it up, the new security concept that NATO is looking at would need to address the issue of whether security will be constructed in this part of the world together with Russia or with an eye to Russia. And I think the answer I'm getting is that both. Of course, it's up to the allies to decide which is the proportion. But a final note on Russia's foreign policy, which is often described as assertive, aggressive, and even annexationist. I think a lot of that comes from insecurity. Russia does not want isolation, in my view, but it wants terms of engagement be reached between Russia and the Western alliance that would suit the Russian national security interests. The Russians often have difficulties with self-expression. I find constant references to legally binding treaties or informal references to buffer zones or neutral cushions to be not particularly helpful. They won't do that. They won't do the trick. Basically, we're facing two tasks in this part of the world. Russia's insecurity vis-a-vis, I would say, primarily the United States. It borders on obsession even. And Russia's neighbors' insecurity vis-a-vis Russia. And again, these are very strong feelings. both could be only resolved through inclusion on the basis of common interests. And as the Secretary General pointed to those common interests, I think that they far outweigh whatever differences Russia and NATO countries have. And very finally, how would it work? Missile defense, turn it from a liability into an asset, a joint system. Afghanistan, expand from transit to include drugs, regional collaboration. Iran, reassess it and march forward on Iran. And just remember that the strategic arms control process started a year after the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. These things need to bring us, I think, more to our senses with regard to Iran. Finally, Russia needs to reach out to its neighbors to the west. Europe does not start from looking from Russia does not start on the order. It starts far closer to Russia's borders. Okay. The NATO-Russia Council needs to be an all-weather institution for building confidence primarily. And my very final phrase will be that in the 20th century, there were two great inventions. One was called NATO. The other one was called the European Union. As we have, as we started the 21st century, we need, I think, two great projects. One project would be something like a Euro-Atlantic security community that would include Russia and its neighbors, and a pan-European economic space that would also include the same countries. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much. Dmitry, I think you've also answered my question about a European security architecture, since a community notably is rather less than an architecture. With that, I would like to move to Lord Levine of Port Sokin. Now, we know that the huge economic damage done to the world of shipping by Paris, he has brought together the worlds of NATO and Lloyd's recently. But of course, also in a more abstract sense, Lloyd's and institutions like it have done for a very long time what NATO is only beginning to learn how to do, quantify risks, assess probabilities, and to prioritize them. Lord Levine, what can NATO learn from Lloyd's? And let me be, I suppose this might be a little rude for me to ask, but does the financial crisis not show that the methods of quantifying risk and assessing risk that we thought were so reliable perhaps weren't as good as we thought after all?
Well, Secretary General Constance, good morning. NATO and Lloyd's do have one key thing in common. We're both in the business of risk, as you said. For over 320 years, Lloyd's has been the place where the world takes risk, and it's no different today. What we've inevitably seen, though, is a huge shift in the type of risks that we cover. And I would like to ensure Michael Williams that there are reinsurers who do care about this, despite those he might meet in London. Nothing in this world remains static for very long. This is never truer than risk. One risk recedes, and another one emerges. Now, NATO is renewing its strategic concept, and this process is a good analogy for thinking about how businesses and, indeed, how all organizations should adapt to risk. Recent events, not least 9/11 or the financial crisis, show us that the unthinkable not merely became thinkable, but happened with the devastating consequences that we're all aware of. Businesses must become ever better researching, analyzing, anticipating, and then preparing for future risks. Today, the 7th of July, is an anniversary which is being commemorated in London, and is a sober reminder of the changing nature of risk. On the 7th of July 2005, four British Muslims blew themselves up on the London transport system, killing 52 people and injuring hundreds of others. And while London is no stranger to terrorism, the current strain of homegrown terrorism presents a very menacing and constant threat. We've witnessed fundamental changes in our risk landscape that pose challenges for businesses and governments alike. 10 years ago, I doubt that very many of us had even heard of nanotechnology, had thought that computers could be launched to attack on businesses, who believed that pirates would be once again ranging on the high seas, and that terrorists would be being nurtured in our schools and colleges. Political risk is not new, and threats such as piracy and civil unrest, have been around for centuries. But these risks are being redefined and are evolving in response to the economic downturn. These risks are compounding what is an already volatile situation with instances of political violence rising, which impact supply chains, raise fears of cyber terrorism, and create new homegrown terrorists. Political risks are also likely to magnify the effects of other emerging risks, chiefly, of course, that of climate change. Climate change, as well as population growth and urbanization, are interacting to cause concerns about water shortage, catastrophic loss, energy security, food security, and migrations. For the insurance industry, climate change is a priority at the moment, even though many of the effects would not be fully felt for decades. And who would have thought that birds, pigs, and cattle could strike fear into humans? The current swine flu outbreak that we are facing is a mixture of pig, bird, and human viruses in a combination that's never been seen before. It has jumped the species barrier and is spreading from human to human. A flu pandemic as severe as that which was witnessed in 1918 would kill tens of millions and is predicted to cause a global recession with estimated impacts of between 1 to 10% of the world's GDP. The current swine flu pandemic clearly shows the implications of international travel, larger populations, and the increasing trend for people to live in densely populated cities. And are we thinking the unthinkable? Insurers are subject to unpredicted risk all the time. Who would have thought that terrorists would carry out multiple hijacks and fly the planes into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon? Who amongst insurers would have thought the policies written to cover aviation, property damage, business interruption, employers' liability, fine, art, life insurance, and disability insurance could all be triggered simultaneously? Except that 9/11 did cause such a combination. Who would have believed that the default of a small number of mortgages in the United States could lead the world into global recession? These are not individual elements. They're part of a complex web that makes up our global society. Unequal distribution of wealth, water, and food shortages in some regions, differences in religious views combined with light passenger security and planes that are easier to fly created the conditions for 9/11. And I would like to pose this question to the armed services across Europe and the US. Should they play a key role in the aftermath of hurricanes, which they do today with floods and other natural disasters, but should part of that budget be invested in mitigation and adaptation strategies to actually help reduce the effects of climate change? However tempting it may be to leave discussions of these issues to politicians and policymakers, it is clear that these risks will have major economic and business implications, and that's why it's crucially important that businesses engage fully in the discussions. We bring to the table an insight into the realities of emerging risk as they affect our operations. For us, it is not conjecture or an academic treatise. It is reality, not merely the bottom line, but the future survival of our businesses, which is at stake. And I hope, Secretary General, you forgive me for making one point today. I am struck by what I sense as a somewhat introspective group of the very distinguished people who are here, the leaders of NATO, the military, politicians, and academics. I'm not suggesting the hall should be filled with milkmen, but I think that a larger assembly of representatives of what I term the real economy should join those with whom you now debate the future direction of NATO's strategic concept. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lord Levine. Let me ask you something. It's been my understanding that, particularly in the last decade, there has been a lot of contact between, shall I say, the hard power providers proper and the business world, as the hard power providers have understood that they are now in the business of risk management. Have you seen them learn from business?
I don't think there's been enough contact. I think it's rather like lobbing things over the wall at each other and waiting to see what happens when they land on the other side. And I think that the opportunity for such an event as this to have a real dialogue between, and I don't want to say the two sides, it's not the two sides, it's all on one side, but between those who have different functions would be a very valuable thing to undertake. And I think if one of the outcomes of this can be an increase in that dialogue, I think it would be a very good thing.
Okay, I think that's been duly noted. Thank you very much. With that, let me move to our fifth and last speaker, Dr. Paolo Scaroni of ENI. Now, I hardly need to explain why you are on this panel. We have all seen oil price volatility and gas supply scares alerting not just governments but consumers worldwide to the issue of energy security. And we've had some very senior policymakers and politicians, not least the US Senator Richard Lugar, suggesting that energy security should actually be put on NATO's agenda as a security threat proper. Now, do you think that NATO should get involved in providing energy security? Would that be good for your company? And if so, in what way?
Well, good morning. Good morning, everybody. I think in my short speech I will give you an answer to this very important question. As even NATO recognizes, one of the main challenges to our security is ensuring an adequate and reliable supply of energy. And this for two reasons. The first is energy is crucial to all areas of our economies and our lives. A shortfall would take us back to the Stone Age uncomfortably fast. And the second is that Europe is reliant for its gas on a small number of outside producers, and in particular, Russia. Russia accounts for 24% of the gas used in France, 28% of the gas used in Italy, and 42% of the gas used in Germany. Looking further east, this dependence is even more striking. Russia provides around 60% of the gas used in Hungary and Austria and Slovenia, and virtually all the gas consumed in Slovakia, Bulgaria, and Moldova. Being dependent on a small number of producers for an essential product would already pose a significant challenge to our security. But to make things even more complicated, gas has to travel through a number of transit countries before it gets to us. And each of these countries has its own difficulties and its own interests, which may threaten our security of supply. Ukraine is one example of this transit risk, combining a delicate relationship with Russia with a powerful position in the transit network. Indeed, 70% of the Russian exports to Europe flow through Ukraine. We have seen the effect of this transit risk more than once, and more recently in January 2009, when the long-running dispute between Gazprom and Ukraine resulted in 18 European countries reporting major falls or cutoffs of their gas supplies during the winter. The crisis hit central and southeastern Europe hardest, and in particular those countries without domestic production, alternative supply of gas, and adequate storage facilities. This dispute is by no means solved. Today is the last day for Ukraine to pay the installment due to Gazprom for its gas supply. It remains to be seen whether Ukraine will be able to find the money. But even if it does, this will only be the result of an emergency loan, of which there have been several, including a $16.4 billion emergency loan from the IMF and a more recent $4 billion loan from a group of multilateral lenders to stockpile Russian gas for winter. This suggests that the Ukrainian crisis is likely to flare up again and again. And for Europe, this means that we may well face gas shortages periodically. Past experience suggests that patching up the holes can only take us so far. Finding a permanent solution to European supply security will require coordination between business, governments, regulators, and international bodies such as NATO. There is no magic solution to this challenge, but there are several things that we must do to mitigate the risk of a shortage. The first is to reduce our dependence on Russian gas. This means both investing in alternative energy sources, including nuclear, and also diversifying our gas supply sources. Of course, diversifying gas supplies is no easy task. Buying from different suppliers requires substantial investment in infrastructures, such as Nabucco, that then bind countries together in long-term commercial relationships. The second pillar of a permanent solution will be to diversify our supply routes to reduce our reliance on Ukraine. On this front, progress is being made on the Nord Stream and South Stream projects. The third pillar will be to ensure that once we get the gas into Europe, it can freely flow wherever it is needed. That means working on the integration of national gas networks to interconnect different countries within the EU. Last but not least, we need a team of experts, the gas blue helmets, which enjoys the respect and trust of the EU, transit countries and Russia. This team will identify the rights and wrongs of the next inevitable crisis and contribute to a peaceful settlement. But even if we do everything in our power to build new pipelines, circumvent Ukraine, shake hands and sign agreements with new gas-producing countries, save energies, develop renewables, over the next 10 years, our dependence on Russia will probably increase rather than decrease, as Mr. Putin knows very well. Under these circumstances, it makes sense for European countries and the EU to build a safeguard, good and cooperative relationship with Russia, with which we have geographical, historical, and cultural links consolidated by decades of mutually profitable trading. Within this relationship, energy security will be at the top of the agenda, as President Obama acknowledged yesterday in Moscow. Creating a cooperative environment with Russia is one of the most important challenges we all face. Business, European governments, and international organizations, starting from NATO. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, this is going to be very difficult to sum up, and I'm not even going to try to repeat what all of you have said. I think you've given us a very rich selection of issues, and I think if we were to put it in a one-liner, I think the message to NATO is, get involved, but you're going to have to do better. The second message is, actually, we're not even that interested in your military capabilities. We are even more interested in your abilities, or not, as the case may be, as a political alliance. We need the West, America, and Europe's members of NATO, and Canada, of course, never forget Canada, to focus on the political issues facing us. And maybe security, and particularly the application of hard power, is only then the last piece of that puzzle. What this, of course, could also turn into, listening to the five of you, it could turn into a gigantic game of passing the buck between NATO and other regional and international organizations and national governments, and the military side of things and the civilian side of things, which I would say, quite frankly, is what we are seeing happening now and which we would like to all to improve, but clearly don't quite know how. Now, I've got a lot of questions. Thank you very much. I know the air in this room is absolutely awful and the atmosphere leaves much to be desired. I think this is everybody's nightmare of a global NATO, right? I think Ambassador Dalder, you know, you need to be careful of your wishes coming true. Now, but let me start with a couple of questions, and there are even more coming here, some of them in completely unreadable handwriting. I'm going to have to read some of them while I'm listening to you answer questions. But I've got some first ones addressed to, where have I got them? To Mr. Albarade. And these are the following, from Giles Merritt and Edgar Buckley. Giles, could you avail yourself of a microphone? Where are you? Over there, okay. And then Edgar Buckley next. If you could sort of make yourself seen to the next person with a microphone near you.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Edgar.
Giles Merritt from the Security and Defence Agenda think tank here in Brussels, and also editor of Europe's World, the policy journal. I wanted to pick up on doctrinal parity because I agreed, but was very unclear what he meant about the global role of NATO. Do you think we could define the West's security much more closely before we talk about the global role? Because it seems to me we have to let the world know what NATO is all about. Is it an offensive, defensive instrument for protecting the wealth of the West? I think we in the West see ourselves as having some sort of a moral obligation because we're rich and happy to keep the world stable. But I'm not sure the world sees it that way. And it seems to me that in the 21st century, the West is going to be in retreat. With a population of 9 billion people, industrialization of Asia and so on, the question is, what are our security interests? And how are we going to reassure the rest of the world that NATO is a good thing?
I'm going to ask Edgar Buckley to follow up with his question. And to El Baradei.
Yes, thank you very much, Constance. Mohammed El Baradei said that, correctly, I think, that the global security system is dysfunctional. We can see how that is true. And he suggested that we need to choose and define the role of NATO. Are we there to provide security for all? Is security indivisible? Or are we there to provide security for our members' self-interest? I'm not quite sure that that's the correct choice. It seems to me that it's precisely because the global security system is dysfunctional that we need NATO to look after the security interests of the allies, but it doesn't necessarily stop there. We're going to provide for our own security, but we can do other things too. So you get a little bit of a plus on that. And in the strategic concept, perhaps we should look at perhaps some guidance, some principles of what are these things that we're going to do which may be over and above what our members' security interests are. Some criteria such as humanitarian distress, natural disasters was another thing mentioned by Mohammed El-Baradei. Legal authority, obviously, is an important point. The likelihood of success, geography, the effect on our own territories. It seems to me that we should choose this path rather than the implied choice in what Mohammed El-Baradei said, which is to devote the assets of NATO to the UN, which I think simply would not work. We would not succeed if we went down that path.
Okay, my last question to Dr. El-Baradei is from José Lelo from Portugal. Could you avail yourself of the microphone?
Thank you, I'm here. Thank you. I was hearing what you said, Mr. Baradei, and I was feeling myself a little confusing. Because after hearing all the other speakers, I listed all the threats they are facing with, and is energy, climate change, falling countries, organized crime, traffic, massive destruction, weapons proliferation, threat of ballistic missiles, terrorism, fundamentalism, piracy, national disasters, and so on and so. So, I feel myself a little confused. It's only a task for NATO. What should we do in order to cooperate, to organize, which is the NATO's business, which is United Nations business, and you emphasize which is legal, which is legitimate. So I think that we need an overall overall reflection on this, because I think it's too much for an organization that is focused in the Euro-Atlantic security task. And look what's happening in Afghanistan. It's not only a military threat. It's a threat to threat. Who's going to control the other countries who let the terrorism trafficking the drugs? It's something that is going beyond our own capacity. It's only a comment I ask you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Over to you, Dr. Dardai.
Thank you very much. I think these are very good questions, which shows the complexity of the task ahead of us. If we start from the premise that security is indivisible and that we need to move toward a system of cooperative security, then I think I can answer these questions in an easy way. In no way I'm, of course, suggesting that NATO should do all of the above. I mean, it really is a question of division of labor, comparative advantage. You want to define exactly what you want to do, but if you accept that security is global and cooperative, you need to develop your concept with the other players, and that's what one of the issues I mentioned. You need to get Russia involved, you need China involved, you need to get India involved. Then you can decide what exactly can they you do and can they and what they can do. It has to be cooperative. No one organization can do it. The relationship with the UN is like the Pope. I mean, the UN does not really have the authority, the troops. The UN gives you the legal authority, the legitimacy, if you like. Well, this is important. As I said, we have seen that in Iraq, for example. You can go to war without the legal authority, and you will not win the heart and minds of the people, which is absolutely important to winning any conflict. So the question is, in no way I'm suggesting that NATO should do all of the above, but also I would recommend that NATO develop its concept in cooperation with others and have a proper division of labor, what the European Union can do, what the African Union can do, what the Arab League can do. Many of them are just simply sitting on the fence, frankly. And they have to be involved. I mean, and people have to know that security costs money. And you have, as Constanza, you rightly said, you don't have to wait until you have to use armed force. I mean, there's a lot of that can be done before that. And that's where, frankly, Security Council is sitting on the fence, that waiting until things got out of hand and they adopt sanction, which gets completely counterproductive. Focus on the essential role of the Security Council, which is trying to find a peaceful resolution of disputes before things deteriorate. And in all this, NATO can play as a senior partner. You have the money, you have the resources, and somebody mentioned, I agree, that you have a moral responsibility to lead in that direction, but you are not the only player.
Okay. Thank you very much. A functional NATO Security Council, of course, implies that all of the permanent five are willing to, how shall I say, abstain from the use of their veto in order to block decision makings when that is crucial. But perhaps we'll get to that later on. I've now got a series of questions, and as you can see, I'm not taking them in their temporal order, which are, I think, mostly about Europe. So I think I'm looking at Professor Vitorino here, but the other panelists, if they are inclined to respond, please do so, let me know. I've got Hugh Bailey, Hans Binnendijk, and Wolfgang Ischinger. Now, Hugh Bailey?
Yeah. My question really is to...
Could you introduce yourself?
Hugh Bailey, a British Member of Parliament and a member of a NATO Parliamentary Assembly. I chair its Economics and Security Committee. My question is to really any members of a panel who wish to answer. Globally, are security risks increasing at the moment? And should NATO member states be increasing their defence budgets or increasing spending in other areas, perhaps on development cooperation?
That was the question which I thought was addressed mostly at Europe. Now, next, Hans Binnendijk.
The discussion on the panel this morning, when combined with General Mattis's wonderful study on multiple futures, really does demonstrate the broad array of challenges facing not just the alliance, but the transatlantic community. And question is, you know, how do we develop capabilities to deal with that broad spectrum of risks? NATO can do some of it. It needs to stretch its capabilities beyond traditional defense. It probably needs to move more dramatically into the cyber area, but it can't do everything. So the other element of this combination, stretching is part of it, stretching the capabilities within the alliance. But the other part is connecting with the other institutions, and that's what this panel has been pretty much about. Now, in that context, as we're figuring out how to both stretch and connect, my fear about the strategic concept is that it will focus so much on the high level of analysis on explaining to the 20-year-old that it will miss an opportunity. It will miss an opportunity to push the reforms that are needed and to push the changes that are needed in capabilities to deal with this array of challenges. So this is sort of a plea that as we are looking at a public affairs strategic concept, as we are trying to build consensus about what the fundamental purposes of the alliance are, we need to have a parallel effort that is connected with that other effort now. We can't wait 18 months. We can't have a strategic concept and then say, well, what does that mean for capabilities? We need to start that parallel effort now.
Thank you. And as I think you've been too polite to mention, of course, this from a citizen of a country that used to have strong reservations about ESDP and European efforts to organize its own security and defense, and has now changed its mind, essentially, it seems to me, because it thinks that's our last hope in hell to get the Europeans to get their act together and to be a functioning pillar of NATO, but also to be able to do stuff on their own when the Americans have other stuff to do. It seems to me that those two are very both pragmatic and urgent motivations on the American side, and I wonder whether the European side has taken full cognizance of this. But with that, I come to Wolfgang Ischinger's question.
Thank you, Constanze. I would like to take my 2 minutes and split it up in one question and two observations. My question, addressed to the panel, but also to all of us, is to express my surprise, my amazement, that we've been sitting here now for over 3 hours, and one element which I have always thought was one core element of NATO's existence and objective has not really come up unless I have fallen asleep in between, namely the classic question of maintaining and enhancing the transatlantic link. Is it possible that some of us believe that it is less important, or is it possible that some of us believe that we can take it for granted? We might be wrong on both counts. So my question is, how important is that? My two comments, very briefly. I would like to strongly support Peter Levine and actually disagree with what Larry said earlier on the milkman and on legitimacy. Let's not forget that the Kosovo intervention lasted less than 3 months. The Afghanistan operation has now already lasted longer than all of World War II. And that is why I would recommend very strongly to the future Secretary General of NATO to spend a lot of time and to expect from this strategic concept to be something that will address the concerns of the milkman and the people outside this hall, not just those inside the hall. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to change the protocol briefly, and I'm going to ask people to ask more questions and then move on to a round of responses, for the simple reason that Jamie has reminded me that we need to stop at 12:40 sharp. And, of course, I'm just not as good at Nick Gowing at keeping everybody on track, and I'm always worried that people will get scared about German forcefulness. Anyway, with that, let me move to Jerzy Schneider, who has a question to Lord Levine. And again, if you could all please introduce yourself briefly and keep the question or comments brief. Jiří, where are you?
Yeah, I'm here. I'll be very brief. Jiří Schneider, Prague Security Studies Institute. You mentioned a need of consultation between the private sector and the international organizations and governments. My question is, against the backdrop of the economic crisis, can you envisage a sincere talk about bargain, about dividing costs among the private and public sector as a part of this consultation? Thank you.
Okay, now I've got a group of questions about energy security. One of them is from Ambassador Bjørn Tore Godal of Norway. Ambassador.
Ah, there you are. I now deal with energy and climate issues in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and I'm very happy that both Dr. Scaroni just now and the Secretary General this morning addressed the issues of energy security and climate. These themes are obviously closely interlinked, but they're also very different security-wise. Naval security and the High North was not really addressed by Dr. Scaroni for many reasons, I believe, but ENI is busy up there in the North. We have a tremendous oil and gas resource in the north. 30% of the gas markets in Germany and France are dependent on the delivery of Norwegian oil and gas through both Norwegian, Italian, and other multinational companies. How to secure the infrastructures? We have no milkman in Northern Norway any longer, but we have no difficulty at all in explaining the reason and the importance of the naval build-up of our capacities in the north to be able to maneuver in the area and to secure the supply lines and be active in the oceans. The question is, we have to sort out what are public, what are private responsibilities in this context. Obviously, infrastructure is a NATO concern. What is dealt with nationally? What should be dealt with by NATO as such? What are markets? How do we collaborate with the companies now busy up there? I remind you that French and Norwegian and Russian oil companies are now about to develop the Shtokman field. What kind of security implications do that have? Is that a uniting issue with the Russians? I believe so. Or is it a divisive issue? Those concerns have to be taken seriously while we are discussing energy security in the next decade.
Thank you very much. Now I'd like to move to Gienek Smola from Poland. Gienek, do you want mine?
Well, great discussion. Participating in many exchanges and consultations, I realize that the military diplomats are speaking slightly different terms, even including the difference here, than the civil diplomacy. When you ask yourself a question, especially in Germany or in Italy and other countries, why is the difference? Why we cannot sort of combine the two? The answer is a much stronger economic influence over the civilian diplomacy than over the NATO diplomacy. And here the question about the role of the private business, especially the energy sector, seems to be crucial. And I dare to say that the success of some of the energy companies should not be sort of combined with the success of European security. They are not the two. And the fact of the matter is that we are allowing ourselves that the Gazprom can operate with impunity and in contravention of European Euro's laws calls for more Europe, calls for European energy policy, and calls for liberalized market in which the famous few energy companies would not thrive in such a way as they do at the moment.
Thanks, Gunnish. I'm going to be even more ruthless now and just cut off the questions. Apologies to all those who've sent me questions and who haven't been able to ask them with a mic in their hand. Please feel free to do so over lunch. I'm now going to ask our five very distinguished speakers to do the following in the reverse order, therefore beginning with Dr. Scaroni. To respond to comments and questions that they've heard. You're welcome to respond to whichever ones you'd like or even to questions that you haven't heard, but do so very briefly. And please end with a recommendation that could either be for an inclusion in the new strategic concept or something else that NATO should do if it should actually, if you rather prefer it to stay out of your field, in fact, the strategic concept to stay out of your field?
Let me first try to address the questions I received. The first one from the Norwegian side. No, of course, Norway is a key country for the security of supply of Europe. It's a key country because it's a big producer of gas, increasingly producer of gas, and we certainly need to build all the infrastructure to make this gas available to many European countries as soon as possible, including the construction of the network among the European countries, because in order to make available the Norwegian gas also to those countries in Eastern Europe which today receive only Russian gas, and this would certainly increase the security of supply. Then you mentioned the Shtokman field. The Shtokman field is an international huge investment which will require a positive relationship between the European Union and Russia, which is underway, by the way. Now, as far as the question on Gazprom and the few energy companies which are enjoying a strong position, let me just say that the reason why I feel that we need to have a cooperative relationship with Russia simply because they've got the gas. This is a country which can produce 550 billion cubic meters of gas every year. No other place in the world has so much gas. We are a big consumer of gas. So here is not a question of opinion. It's a question of facts, and I'm just following facts. As for a suggestion, in my short speech, I think I gave a few suggestions in terms of action, in terms of policy. Also, I suggested this idea of creating a kind of technical team which could very well be led by NATO or by any European organization, which will explain to us who will be guilty in the next crisis between Ukraine and Russia. This can be something that can easily be done by NATO or by the European Union. And finally, I think that NATO can play a major role to improve the relationship between European Union and Russia. Thank you.
Okay. NATO should improve the relationship between the EU and, and European Union and Russia. Okay, that'll be interesting. Lord Levine, your turn.
Thank you. I would just like to briefly address two points that were raised. The first from Hugh Bailey, who asked whether budgets were being spent in the right areas. Now, I can only answer from our narrow point of view, but I would say issues that need to be addressed are climate change, cyber terrorism, piracy, and normal type of terrorism. And if we go back to our friend the milkman, if you ask the London milkman, if you had him here and said, what do you want from us? He would answer straight away, I want you to tell me how you're going to protect me from being blown up when I take my next ride on the underground, and how are you spending your resources to help that? The second point, which I think is linked, is the point that Mr. Schneider put directly to me, which was this. In the economic crisis, what discussion can be had about dividing costs between the private and public sectors? And I think that illustrates a serious issue which has to be considered here. The public sector, the cost that are being used, the budget of everyone here today, is not its own money. That money does not come from the public sector. It all comes from the national economies, it comes from the private sector. The London milkman is the one who's paying the bill. And so the one thought I would leave you with is ask them where they want you to spend the money and broaden this dialogue, because to many of them, they won't understand what you're doing. Much of it, of course, is essential, but much of it they would question, and perhaps some of those questions might be worth listening to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Lord Levine. Dimitri Trenin.
Thank you, Constanza.
You made lots of recommendations already, which were very specific, but maybe just the most important one.
Well, Russia didn't come much in the discussion. I'm not sure whether it's a good sign or a bad sign. Anyway, I think I've made plenty of suggestions in my talk. Let me give you one more. The European Union was started as a coal and steel community. How about thinking about an energy and technology community, including Russia, the Europe, and the European Union? And that could be also a matter for NATO to look into. Thank you.
That's interesting, since we Europeans don't even seem to be able to get our own energy policy together. Professor Vitorino.
Just 2 points. On the defense budget, well, my anticipation is that there will be no expansion on defense budgets, on the contrary, and I guess that the buzzword will be restructuring. There will be cuts, need to make priorities, and to have a better allocation of resources, including the pooling of equipment. But this is an old program, and the resistances will come up. My second point is about the transatlantic link. Yes, I thought I was sufficiently clear to say that for a certain period of time, the development of a European defense and security identity was blocked by the fact that from the European side, there was a strong suspicion that this project would not have the backing and the support of the United States. And the turning point was precisely a twofold turning point. First, in Saint-Malo, the French and the British came together. And without the convergence of the French, the British, and the Germans, there would be no European defense identity. And secondly, it was the clear statement by the American administration that they viewed the existence of such an European defense and security dimension as compatible with the commitments in the transatlantic alliance. And I think that that is the most relevant thing I can tell you about the importance of the transatlantic link for the future. NATO does not consume the transatlantic link. There is a need for a broader political dialogue in between the two sides of the Atlantic, but NATO is at the core of this transatlantic link, definitely.
Thank you. Dr. Albaraday.
Two points. Constanze asked me about the nuclear threat, and I need to say here that I continue to believe that the most serious threat that we could impact on our very survival is nuclear terrorism. We are not doing enough. There's a lot of nuclear material and radioactive resources that are not adequately protected. We continue to live in a world which unfortunately sends a message: if you have nuclear weapon or even more subtle nuclear technology, like enrichment reprocessing, you get yourself an insurance, you get power and prestige. And there, I would like to make an appeal that in the new reiteration of the concept, the idea that nuclear is the supreme guarantee should be dropped, because that sent absolutely the wrong message to the rest of the world. The second point is that when we deal with terrorism, terrorism is mostly out of area. And I don't think we are really addressing terrorism. We are addressing simply the symptoms of terrorism. Terrorism, as we know, is development, is lack of good governance, is repression by their own national government, a sense of injustice from the outside world. And we need, while we protect ourselves going into the subway, work on all these issues. Otherwise, we'll continue to have new waves of terrorism.
Okay, thank you very much. Impossible to sum up. I'll try two sentences. One is that clearly the rest of the world, as represented by our five distinguished speakers on the panel, wants NATO to engage with it, with the rest of the world, with international organizations, with business, with other countries, with other regional alliances, with NGOs. It wants it to succeed, although it's never quite sure, the rest of the world, what NATO is actually doing and how it should succeed in doing what it's doing. But it's clear that there is a need for NATO engagement. But if there is one sense that I get from the entire debate, that this is even more about political engagement than about the military. What is needed here is not so much NATO as the military arm of the alliance, but the alliance itself as a political alliance, as the alliance of the West, for better or for worse. And we, I think, will continue asking ourselves in the following panels, moderated by Lise Doucette and Thomas Rees, whether we are achieving this. It is for me to thank you all for your energetic participation and your patience in this room with very bad air. And please, I would like to ask you all to help me thank our 5 speakers for their presentations and their answers to your questions. Thank you very much, everybody.
Constanze, and my thanks, our thanks to you again for a superb moderating job over a great spectrum of diversity. Ladies and gentlemen, also my thanks to the distinguished panelists for coming here today and sharing their wisdom. We're running 10 minutes late, which is not so bad, but I wouldn't like it to go beyond 10 minutes as we have our lunch, for the simple reason that I've promised some of the speakers a prompt departure at 5:30, as they have planes to catch. So we will try to make up for the time. But I can only do that, ladies and gentlemen, if you promise me that you'll keep your lunch break to 1 hour. That will still, Constanze, allow you to go outside and breathe in some pure Brussels oxygen. And there is a buffet lunch, like the coffee, both on this floor and the floor above, so nobody should have too many problems being served. Madeleine Albright is here, and I will ask her to start her keynote conference address at 1:40 sharp. So could I kindly ask everybody to please be back here at 1:40 p.m. sharp. For the time being, again, Constanze, thank you. Bon appetit, everybody.